I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Logic says that if you put vegetables on kids' lunch trays, they'll be more inclined to eat them. But new research suggests that healthier cafeteria options aren't a panacea for better student eating habits. In fact, cafeteria noise and the length of the lunch period also contribute to what a student consumes. The findings come from a recent study by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In the hour ahead, we'll hear about that study and two others. One about the consequences of diabetes in midlife and how vitamins can improve the health of pregnant women in the developing world. Three segments, three Hopkins studies, next on Midday, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. In the second hour of our show today, Rona Cabell is back for the January edition, the first edition in 2015 of Midday on the Bay. One of the things we'll be telling you about is an island, a barrier island off the eastern shore of Virginia that disappeared recently. The last house in that island disappeared recently. Rona will be talking about Cedar Island in the second hour of our show today. Also about program Open Space in Maryland and the future of that program to preserve open land in our state. And also what to look forward to in terms of environmental laws, environmental issues in the General Assembly, which convened yesterday. And we're getting our new governor into office next week, Larry Hogan. Rona will be here to comment about that. That's in the second hour of our show today. The obesity rate in the United States has more than doubled for children in the last 30 years and has more than tripled for adolescents in that same time frame. A lot of us are familiar with those facts, and this is of great concern, of course, because of all the negative health consequences for children with obesity. That's why there's been a push to improve the federal school lunch program. One of our guests in this hour has looked at the eating habits of kids, of students, and reports a confounding problem, even if you make the effort to provide students with healthy food choices, vegetables, on their lunch trays. They won't necessarily eat them. The question is why. Anyway, that's a conclusion and a question that comes out of one of three studies that we'll be hearing about in this hour as we present the results of work by researchers associated with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. One of the busiest places in the universe, I think, the Bloomberg School, and constantly coming up with interesting information based on studies and research that we'll be sharing with you from time to time here on the show. And so we'll be taking a look at three studies today. We'll be hearing about student eating habits a bit later on. Right up front, we welcome to our show Parul Krishan. Parul Krishan is a professor in Bloomberg's Department of International Health. And her research concerns pregnant women and babies in the developing world, where one of the big problems is inadequate nutrition, which can stunt the growth and development of fetuses. A recent study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association looked at the role that dietary supplements, vitamins, can play in prenatal health in the developing world. So, Parul Krishan, thank you for joining us today on the Midday Show.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to join your show.
Well, thank you for making time for us. This is very interesting. Let's tell our listeners how this study was conducted and where. It had quite a large scope.
That's correct. So this study was conducted in a northern district of Bangladesh, in a rural area where there is a lot of poverty, undernutrition, micronutrient deficiencies, and the study was done over a long period of time. It went on for about 4 years, and during that time, we, in a large study area, we call it the Javita Project study site, we enrolled about 44,000 pregnant women to conduct a large, what is called a randomized control trial, to test the effect of providing women a daily prenatal supplement, which contained 15 different vitamins and minerals. It was called a multiple micronutrient supplement. And we compared that versus what is generally recommended for pregnant women in this part of the world, which is an iron and folic acid supplement commonly provided through antenatal care clinics in this environment. What we did was we provided this supplement and followed these pregnancies until the end of the pregnancy through the pregnancy outcome, and looked at important birth-related outcomes such as mortality. Newborn, neonatal, and infant mortality is very high in this area. We looked at low birth weight as an outcome. Being born small is another big problem in this area of the world. And outcomes such as preterm birth and stillbirth, being born too soon, before 37 weeks of gestation, or being born still at birth, were the outcomes we looked at.
Well, let's look at some of the results then, Parul. We're comparing then this multiple vitamin with the iron folic acid supplement that's commonly given. So compare, what were the results like in terms of, let's start with premature birth. Did it have a positive effect on premature births?
Yes. So this was a blinded study, and we did not know until the end of the study what the groups were getting. But at the end of the trial, once we unmasked ourselves, we found significant improvements and benefits of providing prenatal multiple micronutrient supplements to the outcome of preterm birth, for example, which you mentioned. In the comparison group, which received iron and folic acid, stillbirth rate was at 22 per 100 live births. It was reduced by 15% in the multiple micronutrient supplement group, which is a significant and clinically very important reduction in the rate of preterm.
How about in terms of birth weight?
So related to that reduction in preterm birth, this suggests that the babies were in utero for longer, and therefore they gained more weight being in utero, and so their birth weight was increased by 55 grams with the multiple micronutrient supplement, and low birth weight prevalence, so being born less than 2.5 kilograms, was reduced also significantly by 12% in this study.
Hmm. So generally positive results just with a simple vitamin given daily.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is very exciting a set of findings. In the U.S. and in other industrialized Western countries, it is very common for women, when they become pregnant, to take such a prenatal one-a-day supplement, even in a context where diets are quite healthy and food availability is not an issue. But in these environments, such as in poor rural Bangladesh, women don't have a good diet. They have chronically poor diets, and their requirements, which are increased in pregnancy for these vitamins and minerals, are actually not being met. And in this environment, finding that this kind of a simple intervention can have such large beneficial effects is really very exciting.
It seems simple, Parul Christian, but it's costly for families, right?
This is correct. And so we have been doing this project under the auspices of the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare of the government of Bangladesh. And one of the things governments look for is evidence from these kinds of studies to think about what kind of public health interventions can be provided to women, to young children. And so one of the policy implications of this finding is that, A, there will be you know, interest by the government to think about programmatically providing such a supplement to women, because they already have the health systems infrastructure to provide iron and folic acid. So it's thinking about what this additional cost of giving a slightly, you know, more a supplement which has more nutrients in it would be, but also that large international organizations such as the World Health Organization and UNICEF are going to be starting to think about how international recommendations now can be made to switch perhaps from the current recommendation of iron and folic acid only to a multiple micronutrient.
Parul, I'm curious about the health outcomes for the babies. Was there any difference between boys and girls in this study?
Yes. So overall, we also looked at mortality, infant mortality, as the outcome. And overall, we did not see a there was a small reduction of 5%, but that was not statistically significant. But when we looked at differences in mortality, difference in the supplement group by the sex of the baby, we found that the multiple micronutrient supplement, in fact, significantly reduced mortality in girls, but not in boys. And so this is an interesting kind of subgroup finding. It suggests a benefit in one sex, but not the other.
It raises another question for research, doesn't it?
That's correct. and boys and girls are different, and they are born with different birth weights, and their risk profiles are different. So it would be an interesting next set of questions.
Hey, Parul, Christian, if you don't mind entertaining what might strike you as an ethical question that just occurs to me. Mm-hmm. Of course, the point of this study is to determine whether the daily vitamins, that micronutrient vitamin, multiple vitamin, can have a positive effect. But it seems almost intuitive to think it would, because it does in this country, it does in developed countries. So is it a little unfair to give the vitamin to one group of women over this period of time in this study and not the others?
So that's a great question, Dan. I think that in public health, we are always posed with these kinds of questions where you would think that these kinds of supplements would obviously be required, you know, for women. But without having the evidence that can show that such an intervention can actually have a huge public health impact, it is very hard to move policies and programs in these under-resourced settings. There are lots of competing things that need to be programmed, and governments and large organizations are always thinking about what are the priority public health questions and issues to address. And so it's really also related to the resources required to do the right interventions. And so generating this evidence is really key in pushing the agenda forward with regard to improving maternal health and pregnancy-related outcomes.
I understand. And the way to have the evidence, the way to prove it, is in the comparative study. Before I let you go, Parul, Christian, and I, again, thank you for being with us today. What you mentioned, is it the Gvita or Gvita project? That's Gvita with capital J, V, and A in there. This is a research team at Hopkins. What exactly does that stand for, and what is the what's the mission of that team?
Yeah, so the Gvita project. The word Gvita is derived from it's a Bangla word actually, in Jivito, which means alive, and we kind of added the capital V and A to make it look like Vita, because we work in vitamins and
right.
micronutrient research.
Right.
But it is a fantastic project which attests to the great collaboration that we've had between a U.S. organization, an institution like ours at Hopkins, but the fantastic collaboration we've had with our Bangladeshi partners and institutions, and have this project was established 15 years ago, and we have been doing a series of studies there funded. We started with USAID funding, and then the Gates Foundation has been very supportive in the conduct of these trials. Gates Foundation funded this study that I just talked about. And so it kind of is a very long-standing involvement that our group here at the Center for Human Nutrition and the team here has had, and our involvement there with Bangladesh just reflects our ongoing commitment to the country, to the rural areas where these problems exist.
Parul Krishnan is a professor in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health's Department of International Health. We've been discussing with her a study, a large study over a long period of time that took place in rural Bangladesh, showing that a multivitamin given daily to pregnant women reduced preterm births, increased infant birth weight, and resulted generally in healthier babies. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Dan.
Thank you. Yes, and we have two other studies to look at that came out of Bloomberg. A short break here, but when we come back, we'll hear about a link between midlife diabetes and memory loss with Liz Selvin, an associate professor of epidemiology at Bloomberg. So stay with us for that. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here, taking a look at three studies from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We come now to the link between diabetes and cognitive decline, including memory loss, and very interesting information here, especially for people in midlife. If you're between 50 and 70 years old, you'll want to pay attention here. According to our guest in this segment, Liz Selvin, people diagnosed with diabetes in midlife are more likely to experience significant memory and cognitive problems than those with healthy blood sugar levels. Liz Selvin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School. Joining us now, she's the leader of the research team on this. Liz, thanks for joining us on Midday.
Great. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Let's talk about your study first, I guess the scope and the scale of this. Boy, some of this information goes back to the 1980s and 90s, right?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate to be an investigator of the Atherosclerosis Risk and Community Study.
Well, say that fast, would you please?
You can call it the ERIC study with an A.
Wow.
So this is an ongoing community-based cohort that's funded by the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. And the participants were originally recruited in the 1980s and have been followed since then. And that's why there haven't been a lot of studies of midlife risk factors with late-life cognitive decline, because you need decades of follow-up to be able to assess those relationships. So we're very fortunate to have this cohort that's been going on for over two decades to be able to follow people for that period of time to evaluate these types of risk factor associations.
To have a healthy mind at 70, control your blood sugar when you're 50. Let's go into the results of this study. What did you find when you looked at this, Liz?
Sure. So what we did using the data from the ERIC study, this was part of a larger effort called the ERIC Neurocognitive Study, is we looked at prediabetes or diabetes identified using blood tests in midlife, so when people were in their early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. And then we looked at 20-year cognitive decline during the follow-up in the study. We have repeated cognitive tests in all of our participants. And so the ERIC participants come back, they have additional blood tests, and we also do these battery of cognitive testing. And so we found that people who had diabetes or prediabetes in midlife had faster cognitive decline as they aged compared to persons who didn't have diabetes or prediabetes at the beginning of the study. And in particular, people with diabetes who had poor glucose control were at particularly high risk for cognitive decline over those 20 years.
By the way, some of the communities in this study, the ARAC, or you call it the ARIC study, A-R-I-C.
Exactly.
Is the abbreviation, are in Maryland, North Carolina, Minnesota, and Mississippi. And this covers, what, 15, 16,000 people?
Yeah, there were 15,792 people at the first examination.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned first examination because I assume in this study, in order to measure decline, if there is a decline, you have to study people at different ages. So how frequently were the people in this study studied?
Exactly. So when the people were 45 to 65, those were the age requirements for enrollment, they came for their first visit in the late 1980s, and then they've subsequently come back for a number of visits over time.
Mm-hmm.
And during those visits over the past 20 years, and we've had five major visits, we've done cognitive testing at each of those follow-up examinations, and we also collect blood and urine and do a whole battery of tests on these individuals.
Hey Liz, could you talk about decline? How it's measured? We've mentioned decline in memory. I guess there's a memory test given, but what else? What are these tests like?
Yeah, so we did three different tests. So we looked at tests of processing speed and executive function, so like the mental processes that manage time and attention that help us plan and organize. And then we also did tests of memory. And so the tests themselves are called the delayed word recall tests. So that's a test of verbal learning and recent memory. And we conducted the digital symbol substitution test, and then also something called the word fluency test, which is a test of executive function and language. So we repeated these exact same tests at multiple time points during the study, and so then we can look at test performance over time.
So people with diabetes develop these problems faster than those who didn't. As simple as that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. To put it simply, that's exactly what we found.
Okay. Well, here's a question then about midlife. I have to go over my basic understanding of diabetes and how it develops and when it develops and when the risk increases. Is it at 50? Is it at between 45 and 55?
So most of the cognitive decline occurs at much older ages.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to do this type of research, you have to have this long-term follow-up to evaluate what midlife risk factors or what diabetes in midlife, other risk factors in midlife mean once you become older. And so to look at these age-related cognitive, age-related changes in cognition, we know from other studies that over 20 years, people have some age-related changes. What we found is that if you have diabetes in midlife, that process of sort of normal cognitive aging, normal cognitive decline is actually speeded up.
Mm-hmm.
So people with diabetes had an approximately 20% or so greater decline compared to people without diabetes in midlife.
Has diabetes or elevated sugar, glucose levels in the blood, has this been associated with Alzheimer's?
So it is, and this gets at sort of, your question's a good one. This gets at sort of why the larger ARIC neurocognitive study is being conducted. And that's because the larger study is designed to assess the vascular contribution to cognitive impairment.
Mm-hmm.
So Alzheimer's disease is the most common type of dementia that's diagnosed clinically. But we know that if you do autopsies on people with Alzheimer's who've died from Alzheimer's disease, a lot of them have vascular lesions. So it looks like cardiovascular disease, vascular risk factors might be contributing to a lot of the dementia that we see in old age. And so the overall vascular contribution, cardiovascular risk factors, how they might contribute to dementia onset and how that's related to a lot of Alzheimer's cases and the overlap is really poorly understood. And so that's one of the reasons we conducted the ARIC neurocognitive study, is to understand how vascular diseases, how vascular risk factors like diabetes and hypertension contribute to cognitive decline over time and then eventually dementia in older age.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Selvin. Liz Selvin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Hopkins Bloomberg School. We're speaking to her about this study of the link between diabetes in midlife and cognitive decline. And the risk for diabetes, I don't know what age that is, when people are most at risk for that. Of course, now it seems to be you can be 12 years old and be at risk for it based on your eating habits, your health, and, of course, the hereditary link.
I didn't mean to interrupt. So diabetes increases dramatically over age, but over, you know, as you age. Mm-hmm. But obviously, obesity is the main contributor to diabetes risk. So now that we're seeing this epidemic of obesity among young kids, we are seeing a lot of type 2 diabetes among younger individuals, which is very unfortunate.
Liz, we have some callers with questions for you. Let's take a couple while we can. Here's Angie in Ellicott City. You're on with Liz Selvin. Go right ahead, Angie, with your question, please.
Thank you. Hi, Liz. As the wife of a 74-year-old diabetic, I'm finding this very interesting, but he's a type 1 diabetic, and I was wondering if you looked at type 1 diabetics or just type 2s. And the other thing I was wanting, actually two other things, did you look, Dan mentioned poor glucose control, did you look at hypoglycemia as well as hyperglycemia? And did you look at diabetics who didn't have other vascular problems, like their blood pressure's okay, to see whether the vascular issues were the main contributor.
Contributing. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Angie.
Yeah, so those are great questions. So our study was predominantly people with type 2 diabetes, so we didn't look specifically at people with type 1 diabetes, although the relationships are thought to be somewhat similar in the two groups. So we definitely found that those people who had better glucose control were less likely to have cognitive decline over time. So, one of the messages is that better glucose control may be able to stave off cognitive decline in older age. And then with respect to the other vascular risk factors, yes. So we're very interested in the interplay of different vascular risk factors with cognitive decline. In this particular study, we adjusted for hypertension and cholesterol and education, alcohol consumption, smoking, all of the traditional cardiovascular risk factors to isolate the effect of diabetes and prediabetes on subsequent cognitive decline.
Here's another question for you, Liz. Jason, right here in Charles Village in Baltimore. Go right ahead, Jason.
Hi, Dan. Thank you. I'm a 53-year-old with diabetes. I've had it for a couple of years, and I'm managing it. I was hoping maybe there was some good news in terms of what if you control the numbers and manage it well, if the effects of the cognitive decline can be held off, or if it seems to be that once you've had, once you have diabetes, ultimately, that's an indication of what may come.
Jason?
Yeah.
Thanks for your question. Could you stay on the line? I have a question for you when Liz finishes her answer, okay?
Sure.
Thanks.
Sure.
Go ahead, Liz.
Sure. So I would definitely like to emphasize the good news. I think that what our study suggests is that cardiovascular risk reduction and managing diabetes and good glucose control and addressing other potentially modifiable risk factors like hypertension, blood pressure, that can improve cognitive health and ensure healthy cognitive aging over the lifespan.
And great. And maybe lose some weight?
So, definitely that's the other message I'd like to convey is that we know from other studies that even modest weight loss, like 5 to 10% of your body weight, can protect against diabetes. So, I'd really like to emphasize a better lifestyle, physical activity, staying active, eating right, preventing future obesity, losing weight if you're overweight. Those things can prevent diabetes and prevent the consequences of diabetes.
Thank you, Liz. Jason, my question for you was, as a 53-year-old man with diabetes, aside from a sugar test, I mean, how did you know you had diabetes? Did you suspect you had diabetes?
Right. So I was I was hospitalized for a totally unrelated thing, but in the course of the testing that they did, they saw the blood sugar numbers and they were really, really high. And
okay.
So
all right.
They immediately, yeah.
Did you? But did you? Looking back on that, did you have any symptoms of a diabetic?
Probably within a year of when I went into the hospital, the idea of having to go to the bathroom a lot at night, that kind of thing, and there were some other ones that now, when looking back, I can see where that might have been an indication of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
And were there diabetes in your family?
No, not that I'm aware of. No, okay. Not really. Right. No. So it's mostly my lifestyle and what I was eating and all that. And mm-hmm. When I've been doing regular exercise, my numbers go way down. So it's made a big difference.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you, Jason. Hope you're doing well. Thank you for the call. And thank you for the questions. And Liz Selvin, thank you for your work, your research here, and this very interesting information. I guess I have to ask this before you go, though. What's suspected as the link? I understand that there's a link. You've established that there is a link. I guess I wonder what the cause is.
Sure. That's a great question. I mean, the full sort of underlying biology is still unclear. Our study itself adds to the growing evidence for a vascular basis for cognitive decline and the development of dementia. We know that diabetes causes damage to the small vessels in your body. High glucose levels, they cause damage to the very small vessels. They make the vessels weaker. They make them less flexible. So especially like in your eyes and your kidney, holes can form and the capillaries can leak. We don't know quite as much about what's going on in the brain, but it's possible that the elevated glucose levels, the hyperglycemia associated with diabetes, is causing damage to the small vessels in the brain. And that's why we're seeing this strong link between diabetes and cognitive decline.
Thanks again, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me. It was delightful.
Liz Selvin, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, whose research we're featuring in this hour of midday. We'll take a look at another study. This one, Kids and Their Eating Habits at School, with Susan Gross from the Department of Population, Family, and Reproductive Health at Bloomberg. She'll be joining us after this short break on midday. Coming up in midday's second hour, Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal tells the story of the rise, fall, and disappearance of Cedar Island, the future for open space preservation in Maryland, and a look at issues before the Maryland General Assembly as the new Republican governor takes office with promises to roll back some environmental regulations. Midday on the Bay, after the news at 1. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. We turn now to students and their eating habits, subject of a study, another study by researchers at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that childhood obesity has more than doubled in children and quadrupled in adolescents in the last 30 years. It's very troubling because obese youth are more likely to have risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and children and adolescents who are obese are at a greater risk for bone and joint problems, problems with sleep, sleep apnea, social and psychological problems, and stigmatization and poor self-esteem. Pardon me for tripping up on that word there. To combat the childhood obesity problem, the Obama administration has pushed for dietary restrictions for school lunches. First Lady Michelle Obama also advocates for healthier eating habits among young people. Our guest in this segment of the show is Susan Gross. Susan Gross is a research associate in the Department of Population, Family, and Reproductive Health at the Bloomberg School. And her new study examines students and their eating habits at school. Susan Gross, welcome to Midday. Susan Gross there. Oh, dear. We don't have our guest. Sorry about that, folks. There'll be a moment here while we try to get Professor Gross on the show with us. And I go back to practicing how to pronounce stigmatization. How are we doing there? I'm sorry, folks, for the delay here. We thought Susan Gross was on the line holding and waiting to speak with us, but we're trying to get her on the phone now. Midday at WYPR. Let me see. I guess I could set this up a little bit more while we're waiting to get Susan Gross back on the line with us. Is she there yet?
Hello?
Susan Gross, are you there?
Yes, this is Susan Gross.
This is Dan Rodericks at WYPR on the Midday Show.
Hi, Hi. I don't know what happened because I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me.
Oh, yeah. Well, are we okay now?
Yes, we're great.
Oh, good. I gave you this nice setup. Aside from not being able to pronounce the word stigmatization, it was an excellent setup for our chat about your study.
Yes.
Okay, Susan. So let's see what we can do here.
All right.
This study was based in New York City, am I right?
That's correct.
274 children in K through second grade, and you were curious about what happens at school during school lunch when kids are offered healthy choices when there's some vegetables, healthy fresh vegetables and fruit show up on their trays.
Yeah, we were actually interested in all of the foods targeted by the dietary guidelines. So that includes fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low-fat milk, and lean proteins.
Okay. And you wanted to find out if kids are actually eating them, right?
Right. We knew that when children go to school, parents don't really know what they're eating there, and these very young children are not very good reporters or remember what they ate. So we knew that we needed to go into the cafeteria and actually observe what they were doing.
And for how long did you do this, Susan?
So this study took place in the fall of 2013. Because this was actually the beginning of a longitudinal study to look at changes in student eating. So this was the baseline data. So each school we visited during a designated lunch period, and we observed the lunch period for every child in 10 schools who were in kindergarten through second grade, who participated in the cook shop program that's offered by the Food Bank of New York City.
Okay. And what did you find? Kids, they'd get this fresh stuff on their dishes, on their trays, but not all of them ate them.
Right. So we found that even though that they selected the foods, they may not always eat the foods. Let me put in that in New York City, they have the option of being offered the healthy foods, but they don't have to take it. So they only have to take three items that are in one of those food groups in order to get through the school lunch line.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at, one, did they actually select the food that was offered? And two, once they selected it, did they actually eat it?
Okay. And what did you find about the actual consumption?
So what we found was that, for the most part, selected the food, at least took one bite. But when you looked at especially vegetables, that those who selected the food, so almost 50% of the kids would select the vegetables, but only 24% would eat a little more than half. So more than a bite, but not. So 24% would eat most of what we gave them, and the other didn't eat much at all.
Okay. Hey, Susan, could you draw a picture for us a little bit of what a school lunch looked like during this study period in New York City? Ten public schools. Just describe for us a couple of typical offerings on a daily basis for the kids.
So, and for this study, I have to say that we selected the same school lunch for all of the schools so that it could be comparable, because you don't want to select pizza versus maybe a chicken, but that may not be as tempting as a pizza. So we had all the schools, what they had on their menu for that day was a teriyaki chicken breast,
mm-hmm,
or chicken strips. That was a lean protein. They had a fruit, and that could have been a whole apple, a whole orange, a sectioned apple, or a fruit cup. The vegetable was broccoli spears, or a mixture of broccoli with carrots that day. And then the whole grain was a whole grain roll or a whole grain brown rice.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a carton of low-fat milk.
Sounds pretty good to me. I'm curious, then, the protein, I'm assuming the kids consume. I bet you they ate the chicken, and it's the vegetables that you're concerned about. Vegetables and the fruit.
Well, actually,
no, I'm wrong.
When we looked at, there was still 35% didn't eat the chicken, even if they took it, and we saw that even with the whole grain, that followed the highest behind on not being consumed. Almost 38% didn't eat the whole grain.
Okay.
But actually, what I was looking at in this cafeteria was not just what they were eating, but what other things could affect whether they ate it or not. So there were things about, one, let's take the fruit. These are kindergartners through through second graders, so they're like 6 to 8 years old. Think about it. They're losing their teeth, and they don't have very good skills with actually dealing with food, like cutting it up or anything. And in fact, in the school cafeteria, they give you a spork. You can't cut anything up. So if you're given a whole apple and you're losing your teeth, it's very hard to eat. If you're given a whole orange and it's not sectioned for you, you have to peel it yourself. And without assistance, that can be very daunting for a kindergartner. So we were looking at, was food easy for them to eat? Another issue was, how loud was it in the cafeteria? Is that distracting? And if you know really little kids, they're very distractible.
Yes.
And how crowded was the cafeteria? Was it over capacity versus, 50 to 75% full? And also, time. Did they have enough time? So we looked at how long they actually had from the time they left the cafeteria line till the end of the lunch period. How much time did they have to eat? So, because little kids need to be able to sit down and get themselves settled, and then they can eat. And then another issue was, who was in the cafeteria supervising or assisting? So if a teacher was in the cafeteria with them or not, they didn't even have to be assisting them, but actually their presence in the cafeteria.
Oh, that's interesting. So if the teacher was present, what, the children ate more of their vegetables?
Yeah, so if the teacher was present, we saw that they ate more of their vegetables, they ate more of the whole grains, and more of the low-fat milk. Low-fat milk, all of those things might have needed help. So if you think about it, if you have a carton of milk and you have to open it up yourself, if you're 5 years old, it might be a little hard. So maybe just having someone in their presence in the cafeteria to assist them with those simple things, or just encouraging them to eat instead of talk. Who knows?
I haven't been in a cafeteria of K through second grade anywhere for a while. Maybe I should go visit one. But Susan, how much time do kids actually, it's hard for me to do that because I'm doing a radio show, but how much time do kids have to eat?
So it varied. Some kids had up to 40 minutes, and other kids only had 20 minutes or less. So the kids who had 30 minutes or less to eat, they were the ones who had the hardest time finishing their food, that they were less likely not to eat a food at all, and it was usually a food that took a little more effort to eat that they would leave. So less than 30 minutes really did affect them. The median was somewhere around 35, but we had, some who were less and some who were more.
And Susan Gross, were you able to compare how children did in the normally loud environment of a school cafeteria versus a quieter setting, if there could even be one?
So for the really loud, and I'm going to tell you, the way some people measure it in decibels, because 85 decibels is considered too loud for a cafeteria by OSHA standards, measured it by, did you have to yell at the person who was doing the cafeteria observation data collection that day? The standard was, in order to talk to the researcher right next to you, do you need to yell? And if you had to yell in order to be, then it was too high.
That sounds pretty, that sounds like a good measure to me.
Yeah, so we did find that those children who were in the high noise cafeterias ate less of the, or probably didn't even eat their vegetable. They didn't eat their fruit. It was also a factor in the milk. And that might be just they couldn't get attention of someone, too.
Right. You know, I want to ask you about something here. This has to do with not so much your study, but with policy in the United States and actually law, federal law, regarding these school lunches, requiring schools to provide healthier choices. It seems to me there was a kind of a controversial debate in this country, a loud debate in this country, the last time Congress, or I guess it was Congress, or the Department of Agriculture took up this issue of whether there should be healthier choices. And I don't remember exactly when that was, but it's within the last 10 years or so, it seems to me.
It was with the last reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act.
The Child Nutrition Act.
The Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act.
Yeah.
It's 2010. Is when they made the big changes. And I think the debate goes on. It's going to be reauthorized this year, actually, in September or October. So we're hearing them. There are different stakeholders in this whole program. On one hand, a large number of children eat two-thirds of their meals at school each day. So if you think about it, that's like 66% of your total nutrition comes from meals you receive at school. So if we are promoting healthy foods for people, for our children, you have to think about what is the nutrition that they're consuming at school.
Yeah, you know, I call it a debate. It was really a lobbying effort, a pushback from industry that didn't want to mass produce this kind of food, whole grains and.
With the last budget that just passed, they gave them a waiver to wait on implementing all the guidelines for another year. But, yes, there is a large pushback from especially the food. Well, it was a combination of the people in food retail who were the suppliers of the school foods and the School Nutrition Association. Those are the people who work in the food service. Because it does require to serve healthy foods. Because if you want to serve fresh fruits and vegetables, you have to prepare it pretty close to the school time. You can't just throw it in a refrigerator and bring it out whenever. Things have to be chopped. If you make something that's cooked, if you are not using a lot of additives, and most additives are salt, which has sodium and fat, you need to make it pretty close to when lunch is served. And that is hard to do. So it takes more food service staff. It takes the manufacturers changing the recipes of the foods that they've been providing to school. So they have to have more whole grains. Whole grains are hard to work with. They don't always rise like the regular non-whole grain bread, so, and then you have to worry about sauces that have too much salt in it, and preserving meat takes a lot of salt or sodium as well. So,
and it sounds like your recommendations would be a quieter setting, more time to eat, and maybe having the teacher present, and also cutting the food into smaller pieces. All of this would maybe get more of this, more of these good foods consumed by the students. Susan, we got to go. But
thank you.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you. That was my executive summary of your study, too. We appreciate you being with us, Susan. Susan Gross is a research associate in the Department of Population, Family, and Reproductive Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And we've been featuring studies by three researchers at Bloomberg during this hour of Midday. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll take a break here for lunch and then back again for the second hour of our show, Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell, coming up after the news.